You're listening to the Cycling Podcast at the 2022 Vuelta España, powered by Super Sapiens, energy management for committed athletes and coaches. Today we're in Breda.
Well, buenas tardes from La Vuelta a España. Once again, my name is Daniel Freiber. I am the host of tonight's episode. And despite what you heard our friend Rob Hatch just say, I am not today in Breda for reasons already explained in this Vuelta a España. I'm joining the race on Monday, well, tomorrow. I'm flying to Madrid and then driving up to the Basque Country where I will join La Vuelta and follow it all the way to the finish in Madrid. I am joined tonight from the Isle of Wight, I believe, a place I've never been. He is a two-time Vuelta a España stage winner, two-time Tour de France stage winner. I hope I'm getting these numbers right. Giro d'Italia stage winner, Liège-Bastogne-Liège winner, Giro di Lombardia winner, winner of too many other races to mention. And as of, well, not very long from, well, a few weeks away, I think, an acclaimed author. He's one of the finest riders of his generation and possibly cycling's most decorated podcaster as of today. It's Dan Martin, a.k.a. Crosswinds, I think you were nicknamed at one point in one team. Disco Dan, Danny Martin, for the purposes of this podcast. Good evening, Dan.
It's great to be here, Daniel. Yeah, really. I think this is my second appearance on the podcast, though.
First is a bona fide guest, Dan. Dan, did I get those numbers right? That palmarès, that very sort of abbreviated palmarès. Two stage wins.
I lose track, I think. I think the acclaimed author one is still one to be lived up to. Hopefully that will happen. But two stages of the Vuelta a España, which is why I'm hopefully quite useful on this podcast.
I wondered earlier whether you could name the locations of those two Vuelta a España stage wins. The second one is quite a difficult name.
It's things like this that it really helps to have just written a book, because obviously I've read those words a million times the last few months. And
expecting perfect pronunciation and perfect memory recall. Go on.
The first one was stage 9 of the 2011 Vuelta a España to La Covetilla. And then the second one was stage 3 of 2021. So 10 years apart, which is really quite daunting. To Laguna Negra.
The Vinuesa. Could you point to it on a map? Because I don't think I was there that day, but I can't really remember where it was in Spain.
It was probably the closest stage to where I live in Andorra. So it was, We went through a place called Soria, which is where my wife actually did a big cross country race there. So they've got a quite celebrated cross country race, one of the biggest in Spain. And so that's why that stage, it really is one of those places where you ride through these remote villages and see, oh, I recognize that name. And then bizarrely, one of the guys I've met in cycling, he said to me he goes on holiday to Laguna Negra when I met him the last time. So it's quite a random place to go. It looked very different that day because it was dark, I think, when we finished, because of it being nearly November.
And Dan, you mentioned your wife. That is the reason why you are joining us from the Isle of Wight, is it not?
Yes, it is. Yeah, we've come over to see family over the summer. And we head back to Andorra on Wednesday to Thursday. So, yeah, right in the middle of the first mountain section. So this Vuelta a España, I believe. So not ideally timed, I'll be traveling those days. But it's been a beautiful summer, as most of the UK listeners will attain to, I think.
Before we sink our fangs into the meat of today's stage, I was just wondering as well, watching today's stage, knowing that you would be on the podcast today, it's not long, you haven't been retired very long at all. I was wondering whether you get any pangs whatsoever. And you know, there are obviously riders in the peloton, Alejandro Valverde being one very prominent one, who are considerably older than you and are still performing at a very high level. Do you ever think maybe I called it a day a little bit too early?
Obviously, when you see these epic mountain stages and you see the guys crossing the line first, you think how could I have got on that day? But then when you see starts like how the last few days have been, and you really, I understand what goes into being on the start line. It isn't just that you don't just show up on the day and get the results. I understand what goes into it, and also the level of stress and intensity that's involved in racing these days, especially in the first days of a Grand Tour. Yeah, I'm really quite happy being on this side of the fence now, to be honest. And I feel quite content that I had a great career. I really enjoyed it, and I've left at the right time because I still love going out on my bike. I think that's really important.
How's the fitness? How's the weight?
Yeah, full disclosure, I got really quite fat about November time, and I realised I need to...
relatively, for a cyclist, cyclist fat.
I was probably about 7 or 8 kilos heavier than the Tour de France weight, and then now I've got back down to probably 2-3 kilos over because I've started doing a bit more riding with the summer weather and running, and yeah, I've actually found my happy place as far as level of exercise, but also level of other commitments. With the obviously, I've spent a lot of time with the book lately and foraging this passage towards in the media as well, which I'm really quite fond of. I've discovered I can talk about cycling as well as I can ride. Well, I hope so anyway.
Well, Dan, we're going to test those credentials right now because without further ado, we're going to go to the first feature of today's podcast. Take it away, Rob Hatch.
El resumen del día a contrarreloj. The stage summary time trial.
It is el resumen a contrarreloj, the stage summary time trial. Dan Martin. You have 90 seconds to sum up today's third stage of La Vuelta a España. I'm going to start counting you down now. 3, 2, 1, Dan, off you go.
Okay, so I'm going to be careful not to talk too fast so you can understand. Totally flat stage. Not a whole lot happened, which all the GC guys and everybody in the peloton would have been quite happy with. Looking at the route and the fact it's in Holland, they would have expected crosswinds, bad weather, none of that. Really quite run-of-the-mill stage, apart from one important GC guy falling out, in my opinion, Michael Woods. He was going into the race in great condition. He's now out of the race, out of the fight. He would have been important on those steep climbs in the once the race gets to Spain, but he didn't even make it there, which is unfortunate. So as the quite a strong breakaway, not many teams would have expected such a strong break of six riders. Guys like Thomas De Gendt, Julius Vandenberg, really big engines, especially on the flat. Wouldn't have expected such a strong group. So, which led to a very high average speed. With that little bit of wind, a lot of stress in the peloton, few tumbles for a few of the riders. Richard Carapaz, I saw a tumble as well. But overall, quite a relaxed day. And the sprint finish, pretty straightforward, not many corners. Quite a nice right wide road. Although the TV cameras didn't really pick up Sam Bennett being on the left-hand side of the road in the sprint. I think he's really shown that first sprint victory is the most
15
important.
15 seconds, Dan. You better get the classifications. There. 15 seconds.
I don't even know who's in the lead anymore. I know that Sam Bennett won the stage. Great result for him. Who was second? Pedersen again. So two very clear, strongest sprinters.
Beep, beep, beep. Not a bad effort. But
okay. I probably missed the GC, didn't I?
Yeah, I would say failing.
That's irrelevant at this time.
I would say failing to name the leader of the Vuelta a España is a fairly major oversight. But otherwise, I'll give you a 7 out of 10. Dan, we're also giving wine glass ratings. I know you're fond of a glass of wine as well. Wine glass ratings to the stages. This will go feed into a wine glass rating for the Vuelta a España. When we get to Madrid. Entertainment value, Dan, out of 5, what would you give today?
I think it was 1. No? I think it was, especially the organisers, it was one of those days that would have, when the riders looked at the route, they would have been really nervous about today. And I think everybody's going to be quite happy with how it happened, apart from the guys who've crashed, obviously, because the fans, we really wanted some crosswind action, maybe some even rain, just to spice things up a bit. I think the organisers thought that also with the small, there's a lot of twist, technical running, quite a technical running in places, but not too bad. But in the end, it was definitely a stage designed for crosswinds, but the stage kind of fell flat slightly. But yeah, it led to there's not many sprinter stages in this race. So I think they were, obviously Sam Bennett and Bora will be quite happy.
Maybe we'll get on to why... Certainly at Garmin, I can remember you being nicknamed Crosswinds. Maybe we'll get onto that later. But Dan, we should mention that Eduardo Affini, the Italian rider of Jumbo-Visma, is in the red jersey as of this evening. The pass, the parcel, it continues. It began the day, the red jersey on the shoulders of Affini's teammate, Mike Turnerson. Affini was doing a lot of good work protecting Primoz Roglic, I noticed, in the finale today. He is a sort of emerging force in Italian cycling. Affini, very good time trialist. He was a European junior time trial champion a few years ago. He rode for the SEG under 23 team. You know those boys well, don't you? Were you not managed by SCG, Dan?
Yeah, I was managed by SCG. My father was actually the DS there for a while. A lot of good riders have come out of there. Dylan Groenewegen, Fabio Jakobsen. So, yeah, it was really strong.
And as I say, Affini's a rider who's improving, getting stronger and stronger. He began his pro career at Mitchelton Scott and then moved to Jumbo Visma and came very close to a stage win in Treviso, the Giro d'Italia, earlier this year. Hails from Mantova, which, if you can sort of picture Italy, it's right at the top of the peninsula, just underneath Lake Garda. It was also the birthplace of Learco Guerra, who's the first rider ever to wear the pink jersey. And he also won the Giro in 1934. Dan, let's hear from some of the protagonists. Let's hear some truly awful audio, because while I'm not in Spain or I'm not at the race, I'm having to rely on third parties, shall we say, to supply some audio. And it's not of the greatest quality in some cases. I will rectify that when I get to Spain. But we will hear here from Sam Bennett and Mads Pedersen. The audio there is actually fine, so thanks to Amy Cameron from Trek Segafredo. And then lastly, we'll also hear from Eduardo Affini, who's the new leader of the Vuelta a España.
Hard, because I think a lot of people are fighting for our wheel. I think it's just a natural flow that people start to kind of go up beside me and squeeze me off. So I had a few tough moments just to hold my hands wheel.
So the boys did a really, really good job today. Everyone was committed. Julian pulling from the beginning and Cataldo taking over. It was not an easy break to control, so they did really, really well. And I think our young guns here, they really learned that it's actually nicer to stay up there with us in the finals than it is to be in position 80. So both Juanpe and Tiberi, they really learned something new today by staying with us, and especially Tiberi, he did super good. He was there with, I think, still 3Ks to go, so that was really impressive. And then, of course, Dan, he's there to do lead out, doing really well, keeping us out of problems. And yeah, Alex, we know the story. It's pretty much the same. He leaves me on the wheel of Sam, and Sam, he opens the sprint, and it was a headwind sprint, so it's like, okay, perfect. I would open the moment later, but yeah, I picked the wrong way. I went to the right, and then I think McClay from IKEA, him and Sam came a bit together, and I got boxed in, so had to stop pedaling and be a bit on the brakes and then go left and then start the sprint again. And yeah, it destroyed the chances of winning the stage, but it shows good for the rest of the Vuelta. We have still some good opportunities to go.
It's been 7 years since an Italian last led the Giro. What does it mean for you?
It's crazy to be able to be the leader. It's really an honor, and I have to thank my team. I have to thank my teammates. They've actually been thinking about it as first. It's really nice from them to give me this sort of gift, and I'm really happy and proud of it.
The Cycling Podcast at the 2022 Vuelta a España, powered by Super Sapiens. Energy management for committed athletes and coaches. Still guessing on fueling? Not sure what or when to eat and drink on rides that matter? Never again. Optimize your fueling strategy with real-time glucose data, actionable insights, and personalized analytics. We're here to help you achieve your performance goals. Go to supersapiens.com for more on how to track your energy levels and fuel for success.
Thank you very much to Super Sapiens, our title sponsors. Super Sapiens have their own podcast in which you can find out more about Super Sapiens and how to fuel more effectively for your ride and for your events. It's hosted by Zylon Van Eck and Dr. David Littman. And in the most recent episode, Zylon turns the mic on Dr. Littman, so to speak, because he is the head of applied science at Super Sapiens, and he's a very good marathon runner too. And he has been answering all manner of questions about how to fuel effectively and how to get the most out of the Super Sapiens technology. And in this clip from the latest episode, Dr. Littman talks about something that really chimes with me too, and that is the importance of varying the types of food you eat, especially on long rides.
What I would say to anybody who's planning long stuff, and when I'm saying long, I'm talking about probably anything over about 8 hours, maybe 6 hours, is you're probably going to get sick of what you're having. So bring a variety of stuff that you may not necessarily want. make sure some of it's not sweet as well, because a lot of people will get really sick of sweet things. And I know, like, even for me in a marathon, we're talking under 3 hours, I get sick of sweet stuff by the end of that. At the end of that marathon, I want nothing more sweet for the rest of the day. I want salt, I want bitter, I want everything else. So be weary that that might happen to you in a long event and have plans there.
So Dan, second consecutive victory for Sam Bennett, your compatriot Sam Bennett. How well do you know Sam?
Obviously, I've known Sam from right when he was a junior at national team level. So it's, although we've never had a whole lot to do with each other, whenever we cross paths in races and at nationals and stuff, we obviously give a friendly word to each other. But it just shows how important confidence is to a sprinter, because he's had these legs all year, obviously. And it's once you get, he's obviously got his mojo back now with that sprint victory. And also it takes time for his new lead out to gel, because obviously he's got he's working with Ryan Mullen and Danny Van Poppel here, and they're doing a great job.
I think they've been doing a pretty good job since the start of the year. And I mean, Sam Bennett, you'll know this, Dan, he tends to be very self-critical, and in interviews he's always, well, been self-critical this year and said that the lead out has been performing well right from the start of the year, particularly Danny Van Poppel, and it's been Sam himself who's not been quite up to or not been able to reproduce the kind of form that he obviously had been doing for the previous 3 or 4 years. Today, they were impressive in a kind of unconventional way, in the sense that Ryan Mullen was on the front with about a kilometre to go, but then he really pumped the brakes, because I guess he knew that Sam and Van Poppel weren't on his wheel. And I suppose that's the smart thing to do in that situation. And then they came pretty late, or Danny Van Poppel came pretty late, but perfectly. It was quite a wide road, and there was plenty of space for them to move up on the left. And it got quite a nice clear run, and quite a long sprint it was as well in the end.
I think it showed the confidence that the whole group is moving forward. Yes, Sam may have said they were doing a good job, but it's a lot of these sprints is all about the lead out. And also, I mean, Ryan Mullen, he's doing it's a new role for him, essentially. Obviously, another Irish rider who I know well. And he's never really been in, although he's done lead outs with Trek Segafredo in the past years, he's been more of a classic rider and used earlier in the lead out, like probably 10, 5 kilometers ago, even not in that final kilometer. So he's obviously been brought into Bora to work alongside Sam. And they seem to have got a really great rapport going. And it just shows they really believe in him now. And they're making these decisions at the spur of the moment, which is, it was intelligent riding today for sure.
Dan, I mentioned that tendency that Sam has to sort of beat himself up, that kind of self-flagellation. I mean, is that something that you've noticed, and that when you've witnessed it and heard it, you've sort of winced as someone who maybe didn't suffer from that and sort of knows that kind of positive self-talk is also important, or is it something that you can empathize with?
The fact he's putting it out there, I mean, he's obviously trying to protect his teammates, who it is very easy for people to blame. As I said, everybody sees the leader as being super important. He's protecting them, and he's taking it all on the chin, which he's taking all the pressure on his own shoulders. And that was really, that's perhaps why his results have suffered this year, because he's just basically putting too much pressure on himself. And maybe getting left out of the Tour de France was a big, almost like the reset button, and allowed him to kind of step back and then come into the Vuelta, a race that he was very successful at in 2020. And he's really come out all flying now with these first two victories. But I was always self-critical as a rider. I think because you always see yourself as being able to improve. The difference is you just don't put it out there into the media, into the public. You kind of put up a front, because I think it's important to kind of really, straight after the race, it's very easy to speak from the heart, be emotional and say the wrong thing and be overcritical of yourself. And I think it's quite important just to keep it almost bottled up and then get back to the bus and reset and really analyze, well, what did I do right? Because that's also important to really, as you say, you need to be able to be self-critical, but also analyze what you actually did right, because you didn't, it's not like you're doing everything wrong.
I mean, was the focus of that self-criticism most of the time, was it your preparation? Because, you know, we always imagine that once you get to the race, there's a sort of limited latitude in terms of the parameters of your performance are really set by what you do in advance of any given race, particularly big races like Grand Tours. And of course, you're going to do your best on each given day. So it's almost hard. I mean, I guess it's different for sprinters because positioning is more of an issue and timing and instinct. But yeah, with you, was it more thinking back to what you'd done in the preceding weeks and thinking how you could have done things differently?
As you say, I've never seen any reason to look back. I think it's all about looking what you can do going forward and learning from your mistakes. And it really depends if it's a condition point of view, whereas, as you say, once you get into the race, especially into a stage race, there's not much you can do other than hope that your conditions are going to improve during the race, which it often does. I mean, you very often have different form from stage 1 to stage 20. So that's something that can change. I think if it's tactical error that he's being critical about, that shows that he's just trying to improve. But those moments are instinctive in the sprint finishes. So it's really difficult to actually change your natural reactions when they're happening at 70 kilometers an hour and you're making these judgments. So I'd be really interested to see how much of that analysis goes on behind the scenes at Bora. Obviously, that's all behind closed doors, but I know at Quickstep, you'd have quite an in-depth debrief after each stage, even if you've won, to see. I mean, even being a climber in the Tour de France with Marcel Kittel, we'd sit down at night and analyze exactly what happened in the lead out and how they can improve. And that's when you're winning. So imagine if it's going wrong. It's a very, very important part. With all the cameras available, all the information available now. So I'd be really interested to see. Obviously, we're never going to find that out, but to know how much that goes on within Bora, or if it's down to Sam himself to actually pick up on where they can improve. And that's why he's been so self-critical.
Dan, we'll maybe talk about that a little bit, the experience of doing Grand Tours as more of a GC rider with a sprinter and a team having sort of divided priorities. And we'll touch on that later. But just generally speaking, having observed these three stages in the Netherlands, from the point of view of someone who was a GC rider, I mean, how would you have approached them and how stressful do you think they would have been?
I think one important thing to point out is that it was a lot more stressful than it looked. I mean, the fight for position would have been very intense, and just the nervousness, because as a GC rider now, you never want to be caught out of position. You spend those whole stages worrying about where you are in the peloton and having to move up constantly. And because at the end of the day, there's 175 riders in the peloton and they all want to be in the front, and that they've all got a director sportif in their ear saying, be at the front. So although on television it was quite a boring stage, I think those guys are going to be quite tired. I mean, it takes a lot out of you mentally, especially these foreign starts, because it's just a different type of racing to what the guys will be enjoying, I suppose, once they reach Spain. The roads are more technical, especially in Holland with all the road furniture and that threat of wind, even though there was only 20 kilometers an hour of wind today, which was nowhere near enough to split the peloton. Everybody still worries about it being having an impact on the race. And that's enough just to cause that trepidation, anxiety throughout the day. But I think the majority of GC riders will be very, very content to have got out of Holland in the position they're in. Not much has really happened. And now the real racing can start in their eyes.
I have to pull you up. You said Holland there. We had this discussion yesterday with Larry Warbass. I'm only mentioning it because I've been told off about this before. The Netherlands. Oh, you know as well. I don't think we're in Holland today. I might be wrong about that. Just talking about Holland versus the Netherlands, it's reminded me, your old teammate, Ryder Heijdal, used to absolutely adore the Netherlands. I remember this. Whenever I would encounter him, particularly any sort of springtime when the classics were near or had just happened, he would be raving about the Netherlands and how he thought it was the greatest country on earth. Why was that?
I don't know. I really don't know.
Do you have any memory of that?
Well, it's because he did have his time in the U23 Rabobank team. So whether he really enjoyed his time there or not, I'm not really sure. But an Amstel Gold was, what's it called now? The Amstel, yeah. Amstel was always one of his favourite races. And obviously he got second there the one year, the year of the volcano, the Icelandic volcano. I can't remember what year that was. So he was always a big fan of those races. And I'm not sure why. It's a strange place to race a bike. I mean, obviously my first Vuelta a España in 2009 started in Holland, in Netherlands. I keep saying Netherlands.
It might have been in Holland. Where was it again in 2009? It may have been.
I think it started in Assen. Okay. Because my first prologue was on the road racing circuit and I crashed at turn three, which actually, there's a bit of oil on the road. It was wet. So that was not the best start to my Grand Tour career. But it was in that whole start, the whole three stages. Then the last one finished in Liège with a big crash at the roundabout. And it was just, those three stages, or I think it was four stages actually that year, just typified exactly how you don't want to start to go with the rain and wind and horrific weather and lots of crashes.
I mean, you talk about the road furniture as well. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, Dan, but I always think that Spain is the sort of simplest place to race a bike in Europe, just from the point of view of the roads themselves. They're pretty wide, pretty good. And, you know, that you get these long stretches of 20, 30 kilometers with zero road furniture because, you know, there are parts of the country that are quite sparsely populated and it's the absolute opposite of the Netherlands.
There's just not many roads in some parts of Spain. So generally you end up on these big, wide national roads that are just going from city to city, especially in the transition stages. The only thing in Spain is when you come into the cities and the towns, there seems to be a lot of roundabouts and an increasing number now. So the finishes are just as technical as any other, but overall it's a lot. When you're racing in Holland, you don't get 500 meters without a roundabout or road furniture. Or I used to liken the Amstel Gold Race as being almost like race, like a Need for Speed video game. As far as you have all these things being thrown at you, and the 6-hour race used to pass. It used to be the quickest race mentally of the season because you're just so focused and concentrated all day. Because you have to be, and you get to the, it's more tiring mentally than it is physically racing in Holland, and that it just creates this greater challenge.
Saving money on everything for your next project when you shop at Menards. Get your project started right with our huge selection of concrete and mortar mixes. Our concrete products are great for a variety of applications, from installing a walkway to setting a post. View our entire selection of concrete mixes and supplies in store and on Menards.com. Plus, check out the weekly flyer for more great deals happening now. Save
big money at Menards. Big color, bigger savings. Sherwin-Williams Super Sale is here. Get 40% off paints and stains June 5th through the 11th with prices starting at $30.89. Whether you're refreshing your interior or exterior, we've got the colors to bring your vision to life. And with delivery, getting everything to your door is easier than ever. Shop online to have it delivered or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only, some exclusions apply. See store for details. Delivery available on qualifying orders.
El ritmo de la vuelta. The rhythm of the vuelta.
It is el ritmo de la vuelta. As those who have listened to our first two episodes will know, this is our daily trip down musical memory lane, revisiting an official Vuelta song and the year when it was chosen as the race anthem. Today, we're going back to the year of Dan Martin's birth, 1986. The official song was Take On Me by the Norwegian synth pop Dreamboats, a-ha. I think the story is relatively well known. The song was released twice unsuccessfully before a third version became an international hit in 1985, and the following year it was the Vuelta's official song. Years later, Dan, Take On Me became the fifth 20th century music video to rack up 1 billion views on YouTube. Any guesses what the others might be? 20th century music videos that have over 1 billion views on, there are probably more than five now, but the first five were, any guesses?
Bohemian Rhapsody?
Yes! One.
I got one. I don't know.
Smells Like Teen Spirit by Nirvana, and there were two. Yeah. Apparently by Guns N' Roses, November Rain and Sweet Child of Mine. Anyway, that year's Vuelta started in Palma de Mallorca, on the 22nd of April. Yes, the World did used to start in April. And it finished in Jerez de la Frontera on May the 13th. It was won by Álvaro Pino by just over a minute from Robert Miller, who had won the stage to Lagos de Covadonga and taken the Maillot Amarillo, only to lose it definitively to Pino 6 days later. Scott had been runner-up the previous year, looked set to dislodge Pino on the mountaintop finish on the Sierra Nevada 5 days from the end, but his long-range attack eventually came to nothing. Pino and Miller crossing the line together, and the former consolidating his advantage in the final day, TT. Jerez that year became the seventh Spanish city to host the final stage of the Vuelta. Any guesses at the others, Dan? Spanish seventh. Cities that have hosted the finish of the world, the last stage of the Vuelta? You probably...
Madrid's easy. Santiago de Compostela?
Correct.
Valencia?
No. For many years, the Vuelta finished in the Basque country because the race was run by a Basque newspaper, El Correo. So you can probably guess a couple on the basis of that.
Yeah.
Bilbao and San
Vitoria?
San Sebastian.
San Sebastian.
Yeah. A couple of others, Salamanca and Miranda de Ebro. I would imagine that was certainly the smallest place to host the final stage of the Vuelta a España. This Vuelta a España, Dan, I'm going to ask you bluntly, who do you think is going to win it?
I think that Simon Yates is going to win it.
Wow.
I think I think he's got something to prove since the Giro, and he seems in really good condition. He's got a team dedicated to him other than...
Dan? Are they really dedicated to him? Because they've been, I mean, there are obviously three or four decent rulers in that team. There always are in bike exchanges teams. And they've been doing a reasonable amount of work for Caden Groves. It's difficult to tell, isn't it? When you watch the last few kilometers of sprint stages these days, you never know what work is being done for the team sprinter and what's being done for the GC rider. Often it's two birds killed with one stone, isn't it?
Exactly. I mean, I always found it beneficial to have a sprinter in the team. And especially a good sprinter, because you have a reason to be sat. Like, the peloton is basically, there's a lot of hierarchy goes on, and the sprinters teams, if you don't have a sprinter, they'll, even if you're a strong GC team, they'll still try to push you out of the way, and you don't need to be up there. Whereas you have a sprinter, you're allowed to sit up there much more easily. And so and during the Vuelta, there's always one or two crosswind stages, so they're going to need those big guys. You see a lot of teams load their roster with climbers before the Vuelta because it's a very mountainous race. But you have problems on the crosswind stages then. So, and generally speaking, unless you're going to take on the race, there's always one or two. There's Jumbo-Visma, there's Ineos, who are going to control the mountain stages. So I would always prefer to have a sprinter and a couple of real big guys to protect you on the flat stages than to really have a good shot at the GC.
Juan Antonio Flecha on Eurosport a couple of days ago, Spanish Eurosport, made a similar point. He also said that it was very useful when there was a focus and also the potential morale boost the team, a GC rider, could get from, you know, a sprinter getting a good result in those first few days, as opposed to just being relieved that you've got through safely. He said that it was a positive
focus.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
it means that you wake up in the morning and the team isn't talking about you. It's talking about, let's go out there and try and get a stage result today. And that's a completely different mentality towards leaving the bus in the morning and saying, okay, let's just stay safe today. But that's quite a negative attitude. So I think that's, and also, as you say, it's spreading the pressure. If Caden Groves goes out there and wins a stage this first week, a team always goes into a Grand Tour looking to win a stage. And as soon as that stage victory is done, the attitude normally is, well, everything else is a bonus from now on. So, yeah, it's always nice to be able to have a few different cards to play.
Dan, just looking at the course, it's something I've asked all of the guests so far, just about this Vuelta being slightly unlike recent editions in that there aren't too many monster stages, with the exception of the big mountaintop finish on Sierra Nevada, 2,550 meters above sea level. But there aren't any days with more than 4,000 meters plus of vertical gain of climbing. How does that affect Simon Yates's chances?
I think it suits him really well. I think it's these explosive mountain stages, and the route is going to reward somebody who is consistent over the 3 weeks. And although obviously Simon's got a history now of having a bad day every now and again during a Grand Tour, this race will be won by the person who has the least bad day, if that makes sense. I think everybody has a bad day, and with so many mountain stages, it's going to be important to just limit your losses on those bad days. And I think the Vuelta kind of has, it creates a really exciting race by not having everybody focus on one stage, because generally if you have these epic mountain stages, it negates the racing in the run-ups of those days, because everybody's worried about them. They're worried about conserving energy. I don't want to go too deep today, because in 2 days time there's a mountain, that huge day, that if I have a bad day, I'll lose loads of time. So it seems to be a race this year that there's a lot of places to attack throughout the 3 weeks, but there's also a lot of places that can trip you up. So it's going to keep it unpredictable. And I think it means you need to watch every day.
I mean, one characteristic of the route, Dan, is quite a lot of finishes that suit Primoz Roglic, you could say. I mean, in any Grand Tour, there are a lot of finishes that suit Primoz Roglic because he's that good of a rider. But, you know, bonus seconds, the amount of time he's gained in bonus seconds has been a feature of his Vueltas in the last few years. I think there was it was the 2020 Vuelta that he won. If you calculated, if you totted up all the bonuses, he won the race thanks to the bonuses over Richard Carapaz. Your prediction that Simon Yates is going to win, is that, do you make that while thinking that Simon Yates could beat Roglic a la Pidal, or are you thinking that Roglic is coming in not quite al dente to this welter and maybe even injured, maybe even hurting, and we're not going to see the Primoz Roglic we're accustomed to seeing?
It's true. They couldn't have any more different run-ups to the race. Obviously, Simon's come in having won a couple of races in top condition. Roglic hasn't raced since he pulled out of the Tour de France, and by the sounds of it, he hasn't really trained much, or that's what they're trying to have us believe. But I don't think he'd be on the start line if he wasn't ready to contest the overall. But yeah, I mean, it's purely a case of these steep finishes. Yes, of course, they suit Roglic. But I think with the run-up he's had to the race, even if he has been able to string together a couple of good weeks of training, it doesn't give you that depth to be able to race over 3 weeks. And it's also going to be a very, very hot final week, I believe, or find that middle week especially is going to be very hot, especially the stage to Sierra Nevada. But if the conditions continue to be as warm as they have been in Spain, it's that's also going to be a factor. And I think Simon, that's one thing that my prediction could trip up. I think Simon's not the best in the really, really hot conditions. So it's the type of climbs that are around. I think they're ones that suit Simon Yates really well. But as you say, Primoz is good at any type of climb.
Yeah, I mean,
so it really depends on which type of Primoz is there.
Yeah, and just on the bonuses and on those climbs at the end of stages, there are quite a number of riders in the field who could steal those bonus seconds. It's quite well endowed with punchers, this Vuelta a España. I mean, Alaphilippe's there, obviously. You've got guys like Higuita, even people like Juan Ayuso, who, you know, there's a lot of excitement about a UAE 19-year-old. They're all riders who will be sprinting at the top of, well, finishes like the one we've got on Tuesday in La Guardia, if everyone comes in to the bottom of that together. So that will be interesting.
I also think the breakaway.
Yes.
I think the breakaway will win a lot of stages. I mean, yeah. It's going to be, there's not really, with a race like this, there's going to be, that was the difference in 2020 when Primoz won a lot of three or four stages, I think. And there was a lot of short mountain stages early on in the race when the GC was still available. So there wasn't so much interest from other teams to go in the breakaway. Whereas I think quite quickly, we're going to see a hierarchy established, and you're going to see riders go to the Vuelta a España now looking to lose time in order to go in the breakaway and win stages. And I think that's going to take away a lot of the bonus seconds.
Dan, I also wanted to ask you about Remco Evenepoel, and particularly, well, something I touched on with Ian Boswell a couple of days ago, the culture or lack of a Grand Tour culture at Quickstep. Now, you rode for that team. You mentioned riding the Tour de France with Marcel Kittel twice. On two occasions, you finished in the top 10 in the Tour de France with Kittel in the team, and in 2017 with Kittel winning five stages. However, you know, as I said to Ian, Quickstep have had four top fives in their history. They've had two podium finishes in their history. Added to that is the sort of skepticism, which, I mean, I must admit, I still harbour a bit of skepticism about Remco's aptitude for Grand Tours. But increasingly, people are falling into two camps, Remco skeptics or Remco believers, as far as Grand Tours are concerned. In which camp are you?
I think he's still very young to be aiming for a Grand Tour, even though he's obviously one of the best riders in the world, and he seems to keep upsetting the form book, kind of, yeah, doing these unbelievable rides, because normally you don't win Liège based on Liège at 21 years old or whatever he is now. But it's one of the hardest, well, one of the most competitive fields we've seen in a Grand Tour for a long time. And I think he's going to, with a Grand Tour like this, it's got so many difficult stages, but also that going back to the experience of his Quickstep team, I think it more comes down to the experience of the directors in guiding the team towards a Grand Tour victory and keeping that composure. Because I think we see they're used to this aggressive style of racing and going into every day trying to, yeah, get a result. I think it was yesterday. I'm not sure where Remco finished today, but he was, I think he was 13th on the stage yesterday. Yeah, it's only a little bit of effort, but you don't need to be that far forward. Mm. And that's taking risk and it's making a bigger effort. And that's little bits of, that shows a lack of experience as far as being the bean counter, saving that little bit of energy every day that counts on stage 19 and 20. And yeah, you've only got a certain amount of energy to burn in a Grand Tour. And it's going to be interesting to see how, obviously in the Giro last year, when I raced against Remco, he was very aggressive in the first week, 10 days, and then he ran out of gas, you know. And it's, I think he's got a lot to learn still, but that's what it's part of. They don't seem to have any expectation for him. The pressure is coming from outside where people are saying, getting excited about what he can achieve. As you said, Remco believers.
I think there's always a coded message in everything that Patrick Lefebvre says. Even I saw some quotes from him this morning about Jumbo-Visma and how they were on another planet. I'm not sure those are the exact words he used, but they seem to be barbed, those comments. And I can't believe whatever he says about Remco Evenepoel and not putting pressure on him. Some part of me does not quite believe that.
He built a team around him for this race. Yeah. And I think it's probably the most climber-heavy Quickstep team we've ever seen in any race, I'd say. And but also the team is stacked with riders who don't have any experience in riding for a Grand Tour leader. As a team leader, as a GC guy, you need that calming influence. You need that bit of experience around you just to tell you to calm down when you don't, or just get out the wind when you don't need to. And the Vuelta is a special race whereby you can afford to sit back and relax for a lot of the race. As we were saying earlier about the big wide roads, the easier terrain, the peloton, there's a lot of time to relax during the Vuelta. It's not like the Tour de France that you need to be in the top 20 basically the whole race. So learning those moments when you can sit back, especially when you've got these super explosive finishes, it's something that Simon Yates does really well. It's something that, like, Primoz, he's got so much experience now in the Vuelta, he'll know when to do it. You need to be in an atmosphere that makes you just feel confident and comfortable. And I think a lot of the confidence that Remco has just comes from his sheer talent and his self-belief. The people around him need to be really calming and just understand the race and give him the right information. And yeah, we'll see how far he can go.
Dan, it sounds like you've joined me in the camp of the Remco skeptics. So welcome to the country club. Before we do leave, before the race leaves the Netherlands, I thought I'd check in with someone who has been there over the last 3 days. It's time for our Encuentro del Día, our meeting of the day. And it's with the Dutch journalist, the Telegraaf journalist, Hans Hugenberg, who I spoke to when he was on the way to the finish in Breda earlier today.
El Encuentro del Día, the meeting of the day.
Hans.
Hi, Daniel.
Hans.
Hi.
Hans Hugenberg from the Telegraaf. Where are you, mate?
That's correct.
Where are you?
I'm close to Breda now. The finish and start of the third stage of the Vuelta. So I think I'm 10 minutes away from the finish line now.
Tell us something we perhaps didn't already know about Breda.
Wow, it's kind of an old town, but probably you knew that already. Yeah? It's an old town in the Netherlands. Yesterday, Hans,
in the podcast, I talked about, I went to Breda a few years ago, well, many years ago now, to see Jeroen Blijlevens, was about to take on the record, the world land speed record of Fred Rompelberg. Can you remember all of that? I don't know what happened in the end, whether he did or he didn't, but that was the one visit I've made to Breda.
Okay, and you know about Carnival? Carnival is a big party always in February where the people drinking and listening to music and dancing with the hand on each other's shoulders. Maybe that you didn't know, or did you?
No, I didn't know that. I knew yesterday we also talked about, is it Hoogheidendag?
Hoogheide.
The red hair day. Which used to be in Breda, but has now moved to Tilburg.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I didn't know about it, but I live in South Holland. It's far away from Brabant. No, it's only an hour away. But
okay.
We call Brabant below the river, so that's far away from us.
Okay.
But go on.
Well, Hans, we are nearing the end of this Gran Salida of the Vuelta a España in the Netherlands. Judging by the crowds, at least, it's been a huge success. What is the word and what is the feeling there on the ground about how successful this start of the Vuelta has been in the Netherlands?
Well, in one word, it's spectacular. And well, that's what we already knew from the last Grand Départ of Grand Tours, because as you may know, this is already the fifth Grand Départ of a Grand Tour in the Netherlands since 2009, when the Vuelta was in Assen. But and every time we saw huge crowds along the roads during the team presentation. Well, we know the Netherlands is a cycling country, but also the riders. Yeah, I spoke to Danny van Poppel, Wilco Kelderman yesterday again, and they said, yeah, we knew they were crazy about cycling, but we didn't expect these kind of crowds again and every time again. So, like I said, it's kind of spectacular.
Hans, there are a lot of Dutch riders in the field. Have you spoken to riders over the last few months who have said specifically that they wanted to do the Vuelta because of the start in the Netherlands?
Yeah, I spoke to a few of them, like Timon Arensman. He did the Giro, of course, and then he already told me that he would like to do the Vuelta in his home country, because also he didn't go to the Tour de France. But for every Dutch rider, a start in the Netherlands is something special. And we see it again. Well, of course, we saw the team time trial with Jumbo-Visma winning, and then Robert Gesink taking the red jersey. He never wore a leader's jersey in a Grand Tour. So that was very special for him, although he wanted to do the Tour de France, but this makes everything right for him again, because like every country, we saw it in Denmark as well, where how special it was for the Danish riders, and now in the Netherlands. So, a few riders I spoke before, they told, we want to be there, because, like Gesink and Kelderman and Dylan van Baarle were already there in Utrecht in 2015, and they thought it was kind of special. It was very special then, and they wanted to repeat and enjoy it again.
And Hans as well, it's been a great weekend for the Dutch, in the sense that you've had Jumbo-Visma winning the team time trial, and then two Dutchies in the red jersey. Mike Tournissen's an interesting rider, took the yellow jersey, of course, at the Tour de France 3 years ago now. We don't know him that well. Well, we know that he's leaving Jumbo-Visma at the end of the year, but tell us a little bit about Mike Tournissen, as maybe as a character, something we, again, that we don't know about him.
Yeah, well, he was already with Jumbo-Visma, then it was Lotto, and then he went to Sunweb, but he couldn't find his way there, because he's a classic rider normally. He wants to compete in the classics, and he did some nice scores over there, but not like he wanted. But he's certainly a classic rider. But he came to Jumbo-Visma to be the lead out of Dylan Groenewegen. Dylan is already away. He went to a bike exchange. But he came to be the lead out for Dylan Groenewegen. And then, like you said before, luckily he won the yellow jersey in 2019, because Dylan went to the ground, and then he sprinted and he beat Sagan and Caleb Ewan. So he can sprint as well, but he's not a real sprinter. And like I said, he's a classic rider, and not someone you think he would be collecting a leader's jersey from a Grand Tour. But he already has the yellow and the red now, so that's kind of special for him.
Yesterday on the podcast, I think I said that I speculated that he would probably qualify for Hoogheidendag, Redhead Day. Would you agree? Mike Tournissen, ginger hair?
No, I think he's blonde.
we call Stephen, that strawberry blonde, Hans.
strawberry blonde. If Stephen Kreisweig was here, he would be.
Of course he would. Sam Omen, of course, would definitely qualify. Julius Vandenberg as well would qualify, I think. Hans, just the last thing. It wasn't even the eve of the race. It was on it was on Friday itself. Jumbo-Visma announced the signing of Wilco Kelderman and Dylan Van Baarle. Now, I know, Van Baarle's move had been rumoured for a long time. Well, most people knew that he was going to go there. However, the timing of the announcement shocked a few people, and it seemed to me almost as a bit of a passive-aggressive move by Jumbo-Visma. Any word on the ground to that effect? Any sense that Ineos were maybe a bit upset? Bora were a little bit upset?
Well, I didn't hear anything from Bora or Ineos. And I must say I didn't ask yet, but I'm supposed, but you can imagine, of course, just before the Vuelta. Well, the first thing is these teams knew already that they were going to Jumbo-Visma, huh? But now it's in the open, and maybe there's some controversy that they might do some work for a Jumbo in the Vuelta. You could think about that. So that's kind of strange, and I think you're right. It's kind of strange to do it right before for the Vuelta start, or on the day of the Vuelta start to bring the news outside. But like I said, all the teams knew already what was going on. But now it's public, eh?
And in Wilco's case, Hans, is this him definitively renouncing his ambitions to maybe, well, lead a team at the Tour de France one day? Is this him accepting that he's going to be a domestique deluxe, or is it more a case that he just wants to join the best team in the world at the moment?
I think it's kind of both, because maybe he thinks he still gets a chance to ride the Giro d'Italia for his own GC. But like we heard him in the Giro already, and then he was like, well, we have to see. We have a lot of GC riders, and we have to see what I'm capable of. And it's the same now in the Vuelta. So I think more or less he already thinks about not really get the stress of being a GC rider, and he sees what's going on in the next few weeks, and probably his move to Jumbo-Visma could be like a Gesink role. Gesink a few years ago was also a GC rider, but he didn't like the stress. And we know Wilco, well, he fell a lot off his bike because of the stress, of course. So, yeah, with Jonas Vingegaard and Primoz Roglic, he could be a perfect helper. And I think he suits in that role. And we saw that in the Giro as well. And maybe we see it in the Vuelta also.
Well, Hans, I guess you're approaching Breda, so I will leave you to enjoy the stage and do your work for today. Are you coming to Spain?
I probably will when Wilco or Tijmen Aasman will do a good GC, and then I'm going to come over. But the first week, I'm going to watch from home, and then if those guys will do well, because Tijmen Aasman, well, he's capable of doing a good GC, so maybe he's the one to watch. But then I will come probably to Spain and meet you.
Excellent, excellent. Look forward to it, Hans. Well, it's been good to chat, and enjoy the rest of the day. Thanks, Hans.
Yeah, you as well. Ciao, ciao. Then I'll see you. Ciao, ciao.
Hasta luego.
Science in Sport is supporting the cycling podcast at the 2022 Vuelta España. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much to Science in Sport, our longest term supporters, of course. Science in Sport offers all of our listeners 25% off at scienceinsport.com with the discount code SISCP25. The discount code is still valid. It's still working. If you are having any difficulty with it, it's almost certainly because you're trying to apply it to a shopping basket which already has some discounted items in it. The SISCP25 code doesn't work in conjunction with any other discount codes that Science in Sport might be running. But you can get 25% off everything at scienceinsport.com, and they of course have everything you need to fuel your ride before, during and afterwards, whether it's energy gels or the beta fuel or the delicious tiramisu cake bars. I'll be stocking up on all of that before the second half of our trip round Scotland, the Tour de Cosse, which we will be doing in a few weeks' time. Listen out for that in Explore a bit later on this year. But that discount code again, SISCP25.
We are heading to Spain. I am heading to Spain. And, well, it's time for our last regular feature of the episode. Once again, take it away, Rob Hatch.
La etapa de mañana, la cena de ayer. Tomorrow's stage, yesterday's food.
La cena de ayer, yesterday's evening meal. That's the part of this feature that I'm responsible for every day. Dan is not really going to kick in until I do get to the Basque Country, which I'm very much looking forward to tomorrow. However, last night, again, not really much of note when it comes to Spanish food that I ate here in London. I did have a nice Rioja Reserva from 2016. Dan, you like your wine, don't you? I seem to remember. Are you a bit of a collector?
Especially Spanish wine. Yeah, we get into the Ribera del Duero. We should actually try and do a Volta España de wine.
Well, it's funny you should mention that, Dan, because we actually do that, the cycling podcast, in association with Divine Cellars. And I'm glad you mentioned it, because tomorrow, on the rest day, our traditional wine podcast will drop. And that's me talking to Greg Andrews of Divine Cellars and Angus McNabb, their Spanish specialist. We're talking about the six wines that we have chosen representing this year's Vuelta route. And well, you can order those wines from www.divine, that's the letter divinecellars.com. So stay tuned for that tomorrow. The podcast, not to everyone's taste, because we know that a lot of people consider wine chat to be pretentious nonsense, and you're fully entitled to that opinion. Dan, what about the stage? Because we are going into Rioja country just about on Tuesday. So tell us what we've got in store on Tuesday.
It's going to be interesting to see the race arrive in Spain, just to see. Obviously, we all, it's a totally different style of racing. How the weather's going to be, I mean, we...
Dan, tell us where we're going from and to first.
Okay, just to stay... We're going to the Vitoria Gasteiz, and we're going to finish in La Guardia. It's quite a they're calling it medium mountain stage, which I'm not really that area. I think the profile never really tells the full story. I think it's always a lot of ups and downs, and yeah, it's normally a little bit of wind as well. So hopefully we'll be treated to some echelons at some point. Honestly, it's got breakaway written all over it. Hilltop finish. It's too hard for the sprinters.
Yeah, it's
can't
quite
really
tough.
See any team chasing it down. Maybe Quickstep will chase it down.
Yeah, I had a good look at this last kilometre on Veloviewer, and the road books at the Vuelta are pretty shoddy. In this day and age, I don't know how many people at home have actually looked at the road book that you can now download on PDF format, but compared to some other races, they're not very detailed at all. It doesn't really matter for the teams, because they all have their own applications. A lot of them use Veloviewer, and that's the one that I use as well. But the final rise up there to the finish is sort of consistently about 9% down for the last kilometre, or last 1.2 kilometres. So it's going to be an interesting finale.
I think it's not flat coming into there, and it's quite a. I looked at it as well on Veloviewer, and it's quite a straightforward run in. So, yeah, it's gonna be a big fight for position. I guess there we'll see what we're talking about with Quickstep. If they're going to ride, it's a perfect finish for Alaphilippe. So, will they chase the breakaway and look for a stage victory with him? But that's going to burn a lot of resources if they're really looking for a GC ride with Remco. So, it's the stage is going to be decided on. Who and how big the breakaway is. I mean, that's I would say no sprint team is going to chase down with that cat three in the final, and then a descent straight to the finish.
It's going to be interesting to see how Quickstep approach not just Tuesday but also Wednesday as well, because that's another day that may suit Alaphilippe with a tough climb, a typical Basque Country climb on the road into Bilbao. Dan, you had a bit of a mixed relationship with the Tour of the Basque Country. You didn't do it every year, far from it. You were second once on general classification 2019, but you didn't go back after that. You had a couple of DNFs there. You did well in 2011, I think, was that your first one? But generally speaking, how would you sum up your relationship with that race?
Basque Country, it's a great race. It's a race I really enjoy, but it was always just a stepping stone towards the Ardennes Classics. 2019 was different because I really... I was almost going through like a checklist on my career. I wanted to get a podium there, and I ended up getting second. It came really close to the win in 2019. But other than that, I mean, the DNFs you saw, they were purposeful because I always found that the Tour of the Basque Country was a little bit too much just that close to the Ardennes Classics. So I always used to just do 3-4 days, get the legs going, and then like quit the last 2 days just to really get home early, recover, and just get that little bit more freshness before the Classics. So yeah, it's a race that if it was in a different part of the calendar or if my objectives were different, I probably would have done more often. But a lot of riders saw it as perfect preparation for the Classics, but I didn't. I always felt doing Paris-Nice and then Catalonia or Tirreno then Catalonia was always better because it gave you more time to recover, be fresher and do some specific training. But as far as the region goes, the fans are amazing. Obviously this Vuelta started there in 2020 when I was quite successful at the start and finishing on Arrate that day, albeit with no fans because of the COVID pandemic. It's just the atmosphere on that, especially that climb on to Bilbao on Wednesday. It's the atmosphere on that climb is going to be unbelievable. I think LaGuardia, does Rioja count as Basque Country? I'm not sure.
Is it Vitoria-Gasteiz? Yes, LaGuardia you will get Rioja produced just around LaGuardia, but it's also part of the Basque Country. It's actually called Guardia in the Basque language.
Inside. I think a lot of people their profiles that just don't tell this full story. They're really, it's going to be really tricky stages. But the Basque Country always gives good racing, although I think the weather's going to be really good, really hot. So not typical Vuelta Pace Basque weather.
Well, Dan, I'm very much looking forward to getting there. Vitoria-Gasteiz is a really beautiful city, a city of two cathedrals, which is something that's quite rare. And my birthplace, Coventry, also has two cathedrals. They're not quite as beautiful certainly one of them isn't quite as beautiful as Vitoria-Gasteiz cathedrals. It's the capital of the Basque Country, famous for the manufacture of playing cards. Didn't know that. Anyway, I will be there tomorrow evening, and the regular podcasts will resume on Tuesday. We might have Dan back on Tuesday, we might not. It might be Lucky Larry, it might be someone else. But I think that concludes the evening's entertainment. Dan, I'm going to thank you and wish you a lovely evening over there on the Isle of Man, and we will definitely be hearing from you later in La Vuelta a España.
Isle of Wight.
Did I say the Isle of Man again?
You did, yeah.
Oh, sorry, Dan. A lot of good cyclists come from the island, man. Dan, good evening. Buenas tardes. Hasta luego.
Good evening, everybody. Thank you.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burney.